Claire Booth Luce was something of a polymath. Over the course of her life, she was a successful playwright, magazine editor, congresswoman, ambassador, and much more. She was a magnetic speaker and pioneer scuba diver, and she took LSD and regularly conferred with some of the most powerful people of the 20th century. In Price of Fame, the Honorable Claire Booth Luce, Sylvia Duke Morris, examines Claire's amazing life, from the wide range of her political influences to her tortured relationships with lovers and husbands. It's the second of a two-volume biography published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sylvia Duke Morris to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
By age 39, Claire Booth Luce had already been wildly successful. Can you run us through some of her accomplishments up to this point, the ones that you dealt with in the first book?
In the first volume. Well, as a small child, she knew she wanted to be famous, and she kept every scrap of paper, which, of course, makes that easier and more difficult in many ways.
As a hoarder, or just simply as somebody who thought she had an important role in the book?
Yes, she wanted the record kept. And so her collection of papers in the Library of Congress is now bigger than most presidential collections, over 1,000 boxes. Anyway, she started out thinking she wanted to go into the theater. So her mother, who was always wanting to push her in any direction she showed any inclination for, she got to understudy Mary Pickford on Broadway, and then she made a movie at the Edison Studios, a silent movie, when she was 13 years old. And then by the time she was 20, she had married a millionaire, having come from what you'd call the wrong side of the tracks, and not from a family with any kind of money.
So, she went from the movies to other things. She climbed the ranks at Vanity Fair, had three Broadway hits. She divorced that millionaire, remarried to one of the most powerful men in publishing, and then did things like cover the European and Pacific fronts for Life magazine.
Yes, she was.
Have I left anything out?
You haven't even got to the...
That's more than most people can accomplish in a couple of lifetimes.
That's true. That was one of her failings, of course, too, because she had too many talents. And she always said that her great failure in life was that she didn't stick to one thing. She thought it should have been playwriting, but she said, I never reached the top of any particular tree, like, say, Sandra Day O'Connor became the Chief Justice. She said, not Chief Justice, Supreme Court Justice, because I didn't concentrate on one thing.
Do you think that she was more focused on acquiring money or power or both?
She thought that if she could get the money out of the way, so she had security, then she could just do whatever she wanted. She was free.
And she had a two-pronged approach, her own talents, but also wealthy men who helped her along the way.
Yes, they didn't need to help her so much financially, because after she divorced her first husband, a man called George Brokaw, had made his fortune, his father had at least, making Civil War uniforms, she got a $500,000 settlement, which was a fortune in late 20s. And so she didn't actually need men for money, but she needed to learn from them.
How important do you think was the fact that she was born out of wedlock?
I think it mattered a great deal in those days. Nowadays, it's not such a big deal, but I think she felt it acutely, and she actually was never quite sure of it.
How did she handle it?
She didn't really find out. She handled it by ignoring it, not acting, going to get the documents like I did. I went and got the documents, which proved it. But I never really told her.
Because you did know her.
Yes, I knew her the last 7 years of her life.
Did she go to good schools?
She went to two particularly good schools, St. Mary's Garden City on Long Island and also Tarrytown up on the Hudson. But they were paid for by one of her mother's lovers.
And the sense I get is that although her mother was an imposing presence throughout Claire's life, none of it was all that positive.
No, because she thought that she gave her wrong values. She told her, you have to marry for money, you know, you have to seduce men, you have to make your way, because women didn't have so many options, of course, in her day. But
She eventually married Henry Luce, the publisher who gave us Time and Life. Mm-hmm. How did their love affair start?
It was a coup de foudre for him, a stroke of lightning, as they say. They met at a party, and he was rather rude to her because he always had to go to bed early, so he pulled out his pocket watch in the middle of a conversation and just left her standing there. She thought he was the rudest man she'd ever met. So she wanted to pay him back when she next met him. She saw him crossing the room at the Waldorf skylight roof with a couple of glasses of champagne, one of which was for his wife. And she said, "Mr. Luce, come and sit right down by me." So he stopped there, and they had a long conversation. Then he asked her down to the lobby. And he said, "You are the one woman in my life. I want to marry you." It was like just like that.
Had she already written the women?
No, she wrote the women after she married Luce. But she had written a play just before she married Luce, which they went to actually just after their wedding. It was a melodrama called Abide With Me, which was a total flop. But then she went on to write three hits, which were all made into movies.
And The Women was a gigantic hit.
Yes.
When you think about whether she was a feminist or not, you can also think about the way she depicted women in that play and the movie adaptation, which wasn't all that kind.
No. In fact, Claire was not a strict feminist in the sense of the Gloria Steinem or Betty Friedan, because she felt that women, if they didn't want to go out into the workplace, they could have a perfectly satisfying life, raising their children, decorating their houses, and making their husbands happy. So in that sense, she wasn't a strict feminist.
She had four hit plays. Why didn't she just stay with that? Why did she want to do all those other things?
That's why she asked herself that question. But, of course, the war came. Her last play in 1939 was Margin for Error, which was actually the first successful anti-Nazi play on Broadway. And it was went on to be made into a movie by Otto Preminger, who starred, actually, in the Broadway production, too. And then, of course, she went as a war correspondent, and she saw the battlefronts right up close. She also saw the concentration camps when they opened, and she found she couldn't write those acidic, humorous plays afterwards. And, as you know, she converted to Catholicism after all those experiences.
And then also ran Congress because she felt she could change the world.
Yes, I think she felt she could have an impact. But she soon found out, as she said, that Congress was the refuge of second-class minds. She said that after she'd been there about 3 weeks.
You're right. What other member of Congress has dodged bullets in France, bombs in Belgium and Indochina? Who else on Capitol Hill had reported on desert battles against Field Marshal Rommel in Africa or stood in trenches in Burma on assignment to interview General Stilwell or struck up a friendship with Nehru in India? Did all those things get her elected? Did they help?
I think they got her elected because she was one of the most experienced person in the entire Congress. In terms of who'd been at the war fronts.
Was she treated with respect? You say she realized she was among a group of mediocrities, unlike today when Congress is just filled with geniuses.
Yes, right. She felt, I think, at first it was difficult for her because they saw her as a woman and that she wasn't their equal and all of that. But at the end, I think it was Fulbright who says, Edmund Fulbright, who said that she was the smartest colleague he ever served with of either sex.
Although she was a Republican, he was a Democrat.
Yes.
Was this a good time to be a Republican in Congress?
She had an amazing voting record, actually. Her voting record was rather liberal. She was for the GI Bill. She was for equal rights for blacks and women. She was for profit sharing in the factories. You call her now a left-wing liberal, I think.
She should be a liberal Republican or
yes,
a right, if, a conservative if, Democrat.
Yes.
My guest is Sylvia Jukes Morris, the second volume of her two-part biography of Claire Booth Luce is Price of Fame, the Honorable Claire Booth Luce. She did know how to get certain things. She got a good office from the start, and that's not so easy for someone entering Congress.
No, she said go down there early in the morning in the winter and stand in line, and she got one of the best offices. She knew what to get.
She sent somebody to get stand in line.
Yes,
for her.
Her chief aide. And she said she knew what she wanted because her stepfather had been a congressman. In fact, she got his seat eventually.
Did she have much of a legislative record?
No, it was minuscule because it was a Democratic Congress, so they couldn't get anything through.
She once beat out Eleanor Roosevelt in an Associated Press poll for Woman of the Year. In her era, was she seen as a Republican counterpart to Mrs. Roosevelt?
I don't think so. I think she was voted Woman of the Year actually once for her accomplishments. And she never, in 16 years, she never fell off the most admired woman in the world list. She was always at number two or three or four behind Eleanor Roosevelt and Queen Elizabeth II and Sister Kenny, people like that.
FDR and Claire didn't like each other very much.
No, she didn't like him because, as she once said, he lied us into a war into which he should have led us. But because everybody...
So she wasn't an isolationist. She just felt that it should have been done in a more affirmative manner?
Yes. And, of course, FDR was a canny politician. And although he said he wasn't going to send any of the nation's sons to war, he had no choice after Pearl Harbor because Hitler declared war on us and so did the Japanese. So.
You mentioned that she had a religious conversion to Roman Catholicism. Why, considering the kind of life that she had led? It didn't stop her from having affairs, did it?
No, and she had what she called a dark night of the soul one night at her apartment at the Waldorf Towers, and it was after the death of her daughter, who was killed in a gruesome car accident at the age of 19.
And you say that led her to have bouts of depression throughout her life.
Bouts of depression. I think, in fact, a doctor wrote to me and said he thought, after reading the book, that she must have been bipolar, because she had such extreme mood swings, highs and lows.
What was her marriage to Luce like? Initially, you say that he was just struck, dumbstruck by her, but you get the feeling they really drifted apart.
They didn't so much drift apart as I think he put her on a pedestal. And he had difficulty performing sexually because he put her, she was like a Madonna figure to him. He always said that whenever he was in a room with her, he secretly bowed inside to her intellect and her way of handling people.
On the other hand, other men weren't intimidated by her sexually. She had some pretty impressive affairs, didn't she?
Yes, she did, indeed. And, of course, every man who ever met her fell in love with her. She was so scintillating, not only beautiful looking and smart, but also funny. So she had a lethal combination.
Did she have similar political views to Henry Luce?
She didn't before. She actually went to the Democratic Convention in support of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 with Bernard Baruch. But she said you couldn't be married to Henry Luce and remain a Democrat because you'd have just ended up in argument. The whole marriage would have been nothing but argument.
She was a strong supporter of Eisenhower.
Yes.
You note that her campaigning for Eisenhower was very useful to the general and only second in political value after Nixon's Checkers speech. What made her such an effective campaigner?
She was a brilliant talker. You see, she made fabulous speeches, and she was a terrific television presence, as it turned out, in the early days of television. So they used her. She made about 100 speeches for Ike.
You write that she had the gift or curse of instant intimacy, tending to unburden herself indiscriminately on strangers, regaling them with hilarious or tragic stories from her life so that they would soon come to feel that they had known her always.
Yes. You meet her on a train or a plane or anything, and you get off feeling that you now have closest friend.
Did that help her when she became ambassador to Italy?
I think the only thing that helped her was her intellect there, because the men she was to work with, and they were mostly career diplomats at the embassy, of course, very few women except in secretarial jobs, and they were so impressed with her. She'd go to have an interview with the Prime Minister of Italy, and she'd come back and she would give them verbatim the entire hour-long conversation, and they couldn't believe it. So they checked with the Italian Foreign Office, and they kept a written record, of course. And it was word for word. She remembered everything that went on.
This was a touchy time because the United States was concerned about Italy going communist. The Communist Party was very powerful. Yes. She was also did she play a role in the politics in affecting Italian politics?
Yes, some people thought she interfered too much because she said, "We're not going to keep giving you this aid and all." Helping you build all your air force up and all of that after the war, if you're going to harbor communists in the government and in the factories.
She was also instrumental in resolving the Trieste crisis?
Yes. In fact, she had the idea for the solution of that a whole year before it actually happened.
I mentioned earlier that she also experimented with LSD. Is that important for us to know?
Well, it was meant that she was a pioneer. She was so curious about everything. And in those days, of course, they were actually making experiments on this drug because they hoped it could cure things like paranoia and schizophrenia, or at least help in those cases, and criminals too. So she was a part of an experiment on highly creative and intelligent people to see, if it increased their creativity or their powers of argument.
Did she enjoy the experience?
She had good trips, and Harry did too, but her stepson did not. And, of course, as you know, soon afterwards they discovered that people started to jump out of windows after taking it. And once the drug became illegal in 1965, she started taking it in 59. She stopped, actually, sometime before that.
Although she did have a conversation with Abby Hoffman about it.
Yes, and he said to her, "Have you ever tried LSD?" She said, "Oh, yes, I took it, but just the once, you know." She lied, actually.
Well, how did she react to the counterculture of the 60s?
Well, I think she didn't like the fact, because she felt that people were escaping from reality. They weren't wanting to live their life sober.
During the 60 election, she had to choose between the Catholic candidate, John F. Kennedy, or the Quaker, Richard Nixon. Who did she decide to go with?
Although she thought JFK was the better candidate and would probably be the better president, she went with her Republican loyalties and voted for Nixon.
Your husband wrote how many volume biography of Ronald Reagan?
One volume on Reagan and three volumes on Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt.
So is writing biographies the family?
it's turned into it, hasn't it? Yes. He's doing Edison now. He's doing Thomas Edison now.
Sylvia Jukes Morris will be in conversation with James Atlas at the Roosevelt House on Tuesday, July 22nd at 6 p.m. For more information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Price of Fame, The Honorable Claire Booth Luce, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Lippert.